Okay. So begin with our motivation. And, before we start the teachings, we always do the mandala offering to request teaching. So imagining our world like a pure land and offering that completely without any hesitation or feelings of poverty. Offering it because the Dharma is the most important thing in our life, not our world and, all the nice things in it. But the Dharma is the real thing that is going to lead us to happiness. The Dharma is the real thing we can trust for that will bring us real security, not, transient, impermanent things. And then we also do a verse to request the teachings. And so it's very important, in our heart to really have this mind of requesting the teachings because we value them, because we have faith in them, we have confidence in them, and because we see how rare and difficult it is to be able to get the teachings. So with some kind of appreciation for our opportunity, let's really listen well and take advantage. And do this for the benefit of all living beings who have been instrumental in us having this opportunity and who are counting on us to use our opportunity so that we can benefit them. Okay, so have a motivation of compassion as you listen, and a motivation of bodhicitta. So, the verse that we say to request the teachings is, it's already talking about the Buddha's qualities. I have it memorized, but I always forget things when I have to say them. From the from the space of your truth body. Okay, so the truth body is the Dharmakaya. That is the wisdom of the omniscient wisdom of the Buddha, and also the true cessations and the emptiness of the Buddha's mind, but particularly the Buddha's wisdom here that knows all phenomena. And that wisdom is like space. Yeah. I mean, space is everywhere, isn't it? Unobstructed space is everywhere. It encompasses everything. And nothing can damage space. Yeah, because space is the lack of obstructability. So it's there, and nothing can damage it. So in the same way, the Buddha's mind is just completely open like that. It's empty of inherent existence. And then even the Buddha's mind itself is free from all kinds of afflictions and defilements and so on. So we're requesting that totally open, space-like, yet all-knowing mind of the Buddha. So the Buddha knows all phenomena, but his mind isn't a jumble. Sometimes the more we know, our mind gets really overpopulated with facts and figures and ideas, but that doesn't happen with the Buddha. Okay, so we're trying to tune into the Buddha's Dharmakaya mind. So from the space of your truth body,
Come billowing clouds of your wisdom and love.
Okay, come billowing clouds of your wisdom and love. Okay? So it's talking about the Buddha's two principal qualities. You know, on one side, the love or compassion. Yeah, the method side of the path. And then on the other, the wisdom side of the path. And so within this empty space of the emptiness of inherent existence of the Buddha's mind, there's the billowing clouds of wisdom and love. Okay?
Let fall the rain.
Let fall the rain of the profound and extensive Dharma. Okay, so the profound Dharma are the teachings on emptiness on the wisdom side of the path, coming from Manjushri, you know, from the Buddha to Manjushri down to us. And the extensive or the vast part, again, is more emphasizing the method aspect of the path, the bodhisattva practices, and that goes from the Buddha to Maitreya and then down to us. Okay? So in the, you know, empty space with the billowing love and compassion, we're requesting the teachings on the profound and extensive Dharma, which corresponds to that wisdom and compassion that's billowing in the Buddha's mind. So it's going to teach us how to gain, you know, those qualities of the Buddha. And then
in whatever form is suitable for subduing
sentient beings. Okay? So when the Buddha teaches, he teaches with an awareness of the karma, the dispositions, the way of thinking of each sentient being. And so whatever he teaches are according to what that person needs to hear in the long run. And, you know, so we're looking at the Buddha's incredible skill of knowing automatically, spontaneously, without effort, you know, what an individual and many individuals in a whole crowd needs to hear at any specific time. And then teaches the Dharma, which is like the rain, you know, how rain waters the ground, you know, makes the crops grow. So it's, you know, the rain of the Dharma nourishes our own mind and lets the crop of the realizations come. But we can see, you know, that we're really dependent on the Buddha's having practiced the path for so long and with so much diligence and dedication and compassion, so that, you know, all these different Buddhas have this ability to teach according to the disposition of each and every sentient being, what they need at that particular time. Yeah. And so we're, with an awareness of the Buddha's qualities, when we chant this verse, then we're requesting teachings. And we're, reminding ourselves of, you know, this teaching is going to be useful for me. Yeah? It's the, from the billowing clouds of wisdom and love, the, you know, this rain of the Dharma falling down in whatever form is needed for subduing sentient beings. So it's going to be something I can use to subdue my own mind. I think it's quite beautiful to think about this and really tune into the Buddha's Dharmakaya when we're chanting it and think of the Buddha's qualities like that before we listen to teachings. I find it very, very moving. And I remember when I, you know, when I was first met the Dharma, and, you know, and then I went to Nepal and India, I was receiving so many teachings all the time. And then my teacher sent me an exile. He exiled me to Italy. And when I arrived, there wasn't a resident teacher there, you know. There wasn't a Geshe, and I was very much a baby nun, and I wanted teachings. And so in my, you know, when I would do my daily practices, this one of requesting teachings became very, very important to me, you know, to really focus on requesting teachings, because I so acutely felt the lack of teachings, you know. And in those years, there wasn't very much to read. Yeah, we had the wish-fulfilling Golden Sun run off on stencil. And besides that, there was Losang Rampa. And, you know, Lama Anagarika Govinda. You know, and what's her name? Alexandra Deva Neal. And Madame Blavatsky. You know? So, requesting teachings really came from the heart, and appreciating teachings really came from the heart, because I was so dependent on the oral teachings from my teachers. Yeah. So, anyway, just something to think about when we do those different requesting verses. Yeah. That it's not just chanting, but our mind is thinking about this, and, you know. Yeah, I'm offering the mandala, the profound and extensive pizza. You know, that can subdue everybody's hunger, especially mine, you know. So not getting distracted when we're chanting, but having some feeling to it. Okay. So we'll start on verse 192 today. Okay, so this verse is, the topic is the lack of contradiction in teaching the necessity of accumulating merit through giving. Okay, so we've had this kind of thing come a few times in this chapter about the importance of giving and accumulating merit and everything. So Joe Blow, good old Joe, asks a question. He says, if everything is to be given up because it's empty, why does Sutra say we should show respect and create merit? Yeah. So he has a little bit of a misunderstanding. Yeah. Yeah. If everything is to be given up because of its being empty. So you give up your wisdom, you give up your compassion, you give up your, you know, your inspiration. Yeah. Joe doesn't have it quite right. Okay. He's going a little bit nihilistic here. Thinking that, you know, well, everything's empty, so just give it up. Yeah, no, you know, we have to see what is virtuous and practice that. Okay, so why does the sutra say we should show respect and create merit? I don't want to show respect. Everybody should show respect to me. And what, I don't want to create merit. What is this merit business anyway? It sounds like, you know, when you're in school and you want to get gold stars on your homework. Yeah, yeah, right? So we've had that question before, right? And probably that attitude before. Yeah. So Aryadeva says, Tathagatas speak of attachment to practices to those who want a higher rebirth. That is disparaged for those who want freedom. What need to mention other attachments? Okay. So when it says Tathagatas speak of attachment to practices, attachment to practices here could also mean engagement, you know, like you're engaging in different practices, okay? So, you know, Joe has this question, again, why should we do things on the merit, on the method side of the path if everything's empty? Why don't we just hear teachings on wisdom, and then we just give everything up because it's empty, right? That's what Joe is asking. And so what Aryadeva is saying is that to those people who are concerned about their next rebirth, who are cautious, yeah, who don't want to have a lower rebirth, who see that they have a lot of seeds of negative karma in their mind stream, and that, you know, those could ripen and throw them into a lower rebirth, and they are very concerned about that, and they want a good rebirth. Okay? So somebody who's like that, but also this person, so they have a, you know, the first level of Dharma motivation, they want a good rebirth. They're also somebody who is temporarily incapable of understanding subtle dependent arising and disintegration and, you know, the more complicated philosophical items, you know. You mentioned them, dependent arising, and they're just in the garden with the seeds and the sprouts. They never take that to think, oh, my suffering, my misery is a dependent arising, or, you know, my moods are dependent arisings, you know. So they're kind of stuck. So the Buddha teaches those people generosity and doesn't teach them about emptiness or suchness at that time, because, you know, first of all, they're intent on a good rebirth. You know, that's their primary concern. And second of all, they haven't done a lot of purification. So if they were to hear teachings on emptiness, or even on impermanence or subtle dependent arising, they wouldn't understand those teachings. Yeah. They'd sit there and go, oh. Yeah, because the mind just has so many, you know, seeds of negativity obscuring it. So those people really, you know, would be better off doing a lot of purification practices and a lot of practices to create merit, because that's really what they need in order to understand the teachings in a further way, in a deeper way. So that's why he teaches them, you know, paying respect through bowing, okay, creating merit through generosity, you know, ethical conduct of, you know, restraining from negative actions. So this is very much in line with that person's capacity at that particular time, okay? Yeah. And so the way the Buddha teaches them is they teach them those practices that they can engage in and kind of leave, you know, teachings about emptiness and dependent arising off to the side. Yeah, because the person just, you know, they wouldn't get them in a correct way, or they might even get them in, you know, misunderstand them, which would be worse than not understanding them and just being puzzled and confused. Okay, but for people who are seeking liberation, okay, then those people, you know, the Buddha's going to teach about emptiness. And to those people, he's actually going to disparage the motivation for a good rebirth for just the sake of having a good rebirth. Okay, somebody who's intent on liberation, he'll say, yes, having a good rebirth is important because it's a stepping stone, because you need that opportunity to continue to practice in your future lives so that you can actualize your real motivation, which is to attain liberation. But so the Buddha will encourage a good future rebirth in that way. But he's not, if that person starts talking about, well, I just want a good rebirth, you know, I don't want to be born in the hell realms or a hungry ghost or as a gopher, you know, then the Buddha's going to say, you know, he's not going to encourage that person in that way, because that's an inferior motivation compared to his motivation for liberation. Okay, so the Buddha will disparage the aspiration for a good rebirth, you know. And so let alone, you know, having attachment to bad deeds, to misdeeds, of course the Buddha is going to disparage that as well. Okay? So, Gelsenje says, if you renounce and ordain to free yourself from samsara, the Buddha will criticize your aspiration for a good rebirth. Okay? Because to ordain, you have to have the minimum aspiration is liberation. Okay? And the point is, why settle for something less when you can achieve something greater? Okay, so if you can achieve liberation, why settle for just a good rebirth? And then, you know, to extrapolate on that, if you can attain full awakening, why settle for liberation? Okay, but, you know, we're going to be taught according to our motivation, because our motivation is very indicative of our inner capabilities and our faculties, our disposition. Okay? So, you know, we hear the teachings that are going to accord with that. And so they say, you know, when a Buddha teaches, that everybody hears it according to what they need. Yeah, which must be, you know, due to the merit of the Buddha, that his, you know, his speeches can communicate that well with so many different kinds of people. Okay? But, so here, you know, what it's saying is, okay, for somebody of the first level practitioner, first lower capacity, you learn giving, ethics, and things like that, paying respect, purification, and so on. Then for somebody who wants liberation, they're going to have to learn emptiness. For somebody who wants awakening, full awakening, they're going to also have to learn about bodhicitta and do the far-reaching practices. So you learn a different thing according to your own long-term vision. So you might say, well, wait a minute, I'm not, you know, if I'm really truthful, I'm so focused on the happiness of this life, and I barely think about a good rebirth. You know, it's a good day when I really care about my next rebirth. So why am I getting all these kinds of teachings? Yeah? On emptiness and bodhicitta and stuff like that. Well, it's, you know, obviously in a previous life we made some prayers to meet the Mahayana Dharma, and so, and we created the merit for it. So then we have the privilege and the good fortune to meet the Mahayana and to hear those teachings and to begin, you know, the process of understanding them now. And, you know, at the beginning we just have to try and understand the words, then we try and understand the concepts, and then slowly, slowly a little bit of awareness came. But we're getting a lot of good seeds planted in our mind, you know, even if we can't understand a lot. So it's still, you know, even like if some, you know, His Holiness is teaching something, you know, a difficult text, it's still very good to go and you know, hear and get the seeds on your mind stream. Now, to clarify something, it's not that, okay, accumulating merit and purification are just for the people who want to avoid a bad rebirth. But actually, on the bodhisattva path, you do purification and accumulation of merit all the way through, you know, straight through. And if you look at some of, you know, the really great practitioners, this is what they do. Yeah, if you've been around Sopa Rinpoche for a while, boy, we can really get into prostrations and mandala offerings and all of that. Okay, so it's a practice that practices that everybody does, because on the bodhisattva path you really need a lot of merit and you need to do a lot of purification. Yeah, so those practices are not just for the people at the beginning of the path. Of course, by the time, you know, the way you do those practices when you're an initial level practitioner is going to be very different than the way you do those practices, let's say, when you're, you know, at a middle capacity or advanced capacity practitioner. Yeah, because the more your capacity increases, then you'll be able to do those practices more with a sincere bodhicitta motivation, so you actually create more merit because you have more of a feeling for bodhicitta. And then also while you're doing the practices, you're contemplating the what they call the circle of three, the agent, the object, and the action, and seeing how they all depend on each other and that they're all empty of inherent existence. Okay. So you're not going to think like that when you're, you know, when you're the first level capacity. But as you learn more, then you start to imbue your purification and creation merit practices with an understanding of emptiness and with your bodhicitta motivation and so on. And also your capacity to visualize gets better. You know, when you're first doing your prostrations, it's just me, you know, going up and down and up and down. And then after some time, you remember, oh, yeah, I'm supposed to be visualizing all my previous lives, also bowing. And, oh, yeah, you know, what about all sentient beings bowing with me? Yeah. And then what about, oh, on every atom of the universe, there's a Buddha surrounded by bodhisattvas, and me, with all my previous lives and all sentient beings, were there too, on each and every atom, bowing to all these Buddhas. Yeah. So, you know, your ability to even remember to do that, you know, and to think about it, let alone have a clear visualization, that's going to increase as you practice and get more into your practice and develop more capability with it. Okay? Okay, Joe, so that's why we do those practices. Don't stop. You know, like Lama Tsongkhapa, you know, he was already quite a well-known teacher, and then Manjushri told him he needed to go off and do purification and creation of merit. And so he did with eight special disciples. And I had the fortune to go to, you know, those places, that one of the places where he did that when I was in Tibet. This was many years ago. It was a place called Urkha. And it's up, you know, high, this kind of a ridge, and there. And, you know, Jay Rinpoche did 3.5 million full-length prostrations on stone. He didn't have a nice yoga mat or carpeting that was padded or a board, you know, with the mittens that slide. Because when you go there, you can see the outline of his body on the stone. Okay, and similarly, when he did mandala offerings, he did it on stone. They said his whole forearm was raw from, you know, because you're rubbing like this. But on the stone where he did it, you can see there's self-arisen, like flowers and letters and little offering things that just kind of self-arose out of the stone. I think by the fact of him doing that practice and visualizing, and yeah, and it's really quite inspiring when you go there. And you know, we kind of struggle through 100,000, and he did 100,000 for each Buddha, so 3.5 million. Yeah, and I don't think he had one of those clickers either. Yeah. And I don't think he added on, you know, when he just did three prostrations, like before sitting down to meditate, I don't think he added those on to his prostrations. He just did it when he was fully doing the 35 Buddhas. Actually, they say, you know, that in the sutra, they say that, you know, because it says to the Tathagata, you know, so-and-so, or to the one thus gone, so-and-so. Yeah, that the sutra doesn't have the part that says Tathagata at the beginning. But so when Jay Rinpoche was doing his prostrations, he had a vision of the 35 Buddhas, but without their heads. And so then he went back and started doing it again, this time saying to the Tathagata and putting Tathagata before each name. And then his visualization, they all appeared clearly. Far out, huh? Yeah? So. Okay, then verse 193. Okay, so this verse is about the stages leading to the means, meaning of the fundamental mode of existence. What's the fundamental mode of existence? Emptiness, okay. And so it's also about that suchness, which means emptiness, should not be taught to the unreceptive. Okay. So Joe asks the question, if all of our dukkha is ceased by understanding emptiness, it would be appropriate to teach only suchness. Okay. Do you see this question? This issue keeps coming up. There's a few issues that keep coming up in this chapter, and this is one of them. Yeah. Again, like, yeah, why don't we just teach suchness to everybody indiscriminately if that's the thing we need to realize in order to teach our dukkha, to eradicate our dukkha, okay? So Aryadeva says, those who want merit should not always speak of emptiness. Doesn't a medicinal compound turn to poison in the wrong case? So Joe is saying, you know, how come different people get different teachings? Why doesn't everybody just get the teachings on the ultimate nature? Okay, so those who want merit, so here it's talking about, I think, this from the side of the teacher. You know, if you want to create merit, then you don't always speak about emptiness. Because if somebody is not prepared by having heard the teachings on conventional reality first, there's the possibility that they'll misunderstand emptiness and fall to the extreme of nihilism, you know. And you can see this, because you meet people who say, there's no good or no, and no bad, everything's empty. So you don't need to keep ethical conduct because there's no good and there's no bad. Okay, that is big boo-boo, big wrong conception. Okay, but if somebody hasn't studied, you know, how the 12 links, you know, what is samsara, how our samsara evolves, how the mind works, how karma and cause and effect work, if somebody hasn't studied that and they just even hear emptiness, you know, then they invent their own meaning of emptiness and they say, well, nothing exists. Yeah. There's no good, there's no bad. You hear people say that in this country a lot. Yeah? I don't need to follow precepts because there's no good and there's no bad. Everything's empty. Precepts are for people who are babies. Yeah? You hear people say that. It's really incorrect. Because actually, the more you understand emptiness, if you understand emptiness correctly, your understanding of emptiness leads you to understand dependent arising better. Remember when Jeffrey was talking to us about emptiness dawning as the meaning of dependent arising and dependent arising dawning as the meaning of emptiness? When you have a correct realization of emptiness, then this is what happens. And you know, you have a better understanding of dependent arising. And understanding karma and its effects is the principal part of, you know, causal dependence that it's so important for us to understand. Yeah, so those people who talk like that are really misled. But they think that they know something very special. Mm-hmm. Okay? Yeah. Like, I'm practicing Tantra, so everything's possible. Everything's pure view. That's it. Yeah. Everything's pure view. So I have pure view for everything. It's only because of my karma that I have bad view. So everything's pure view. Yeah? So I can smack you across the face. Pure view. It's just a feather touching you. You know? Everything I do is virtuous because I have pure view. Yeah. So it's just people, you know, really very, very severe misunderstanding of emptiness and severe misunderstanding of Tantra. Yeah? Pure view doesn't mean that anything goes for everybody. Yeah? Pure view is something that you have when you have a correct realization of emptiness that also leads you to have more faith in cause and effect, karma and its effects. Yeah, and when you have a correct understanding of Tantra and how to practice it, you know, and when you've really had a lot of purification. But if you haven't done that, then you think pure view just means I visualize everything as being beautiful. That's not it, you know. I mean, the essence of pure view is being able to see things as empty and like illusion. And from there, you know, as part of the mandala of the deity and so forth. But otherwise, just, you know, pure view. Oh, this is gold. Yeah, and this is silver. And I am Buddha. So what everything I think, even if it's, no matter what it is virtuous. Not the correct meaning. Okay, so if you teach emptiness to the people who are unreceptive, people who haven't had enough preparatory teachings first, it will actually damage them. Because either they will reject emptiness, saying it's just total garbage and foolishness, or they'll think that everything is non-existent and thereby disparage karma and its effects, and that will lead them to have a lower rebirth. Okay? So therefore, if you seek to have the merit of caring for others and actually being a benefit to others, then you don't speak about emptiness to people without first examining their level of mind and what they understand and what they don't understand. You know, and what teachings they've had, and if they understand those teachings, and so on. You have to examine that, and not just, you know, have this thing of, you know, well, I'm just this wonderful teacher, and I'll elaborate on emptiness, at, you know, and show everybody how much I know, without, you know, ascertaining who the people are. And I think that is the same really for giving tantric initiation as well. It says the teachers are supposed to scrutinize the disciples before giving initiation and see that people are prepared and they're ready and so on. Yeah, not just kind of giving it. Yeah. So the idea is that something, an appetizing and potent medicine becomes poison when given to the wrong patient. Yeah? So something that's the medicine for one person can become poison for the other person. Same like in regular medicine. Yeah? One kind of medicine can cure one disease, but if you give a person, you know, if you give it to a person who has the opposite disease, then they're going to get sicker. You know, so it's very important to know people's different levels of mind. Okay, yeah. So we don't just teach emptiness indiscriminately. I think I told you that story about Tsong Rinpoche when I went to see him, his previous life, and it was in Dharamsala. He was actually staying at Trichang Rinpoche's house. So I went to visit him, and I had a question about emptiness. And I asked him, I can't remember what the question is. And he looked at me and he said, "You wouldn't understand the answer even if I told you." Okay. And I thought, okay, that's the end of the interview. But then he actually proceeded to, you know, give me a little talk about emptiness. I have the notes somewhere. I should look. I even remember what the book looks like. Yeah, but I had some teachings before, and I think his thought was that she understands so little that there's not even the danger of her misunderstanding it and falling into nihilism. That she wouldn't even understand enough to misunderstand it. So we went to visit his incarnation when we were at Sarah, and also last year when we met him too. Yeah. Okay, then verse 194. So this verse is about the means to understand suchness. So just as a barbarian cannot be guided in a foreign language, ordinary people cannot be guided except by way of the ordinary. Okay? So this, again, is kind of coming down to the question of why do we need to learn both conventional truths and ultimate truths? You know, ordinary people cannot be guided except by way of the ordinary. So we have to learn about conventional reality and how things work on a conventional level and cause and effect and all these kinds of things. Yeah. So, you know, how our samsara evolves, how we get out of it. You know, why do we have to, it's coming down to this, the same question of why do we have to learn all these things again? Okay, well, it's just because a barbarian cannot be guided in a foreign language. Ordinary people cannot be guided except by way of the ordinary. I think I told you the first time I met Lama Zopa. Yeah, I'd just come back from, because I was in this semi-professional folk dancing group, and I came back from a rehearsal, and I had a dress up to here and neckline down to there and my long hair all over the place. I had just had my ears pierced and I had big earrings. And somebody was staying at my flat who was a disciple of Rinpoche, and she wanted to go to LAX to meet him because he was arriving. They were flying in from Florida or somewhere. So I drove her down there. And in those days, you could walk out to the gate to greet people. Yeah. I remember this. So we were at the gate, and Rinpoche comes off the plane, and we're talking, and Rinpoche talks to me about dolphins. He had been in Hawaii, had gone to some marine park or something, yeah, and was talking about dolphins, because that was the level of my mind. Yeah, that was what I could understand, was, you know, dolphins. Okay, so ordinary people cannot be guided except by way of the ordinary. Yeah? Okay, so at the beginning, we teach in accordance with how ordinary beings accept things to exist. Yeah, if you don't challenge people's how they perceive things right at the very beginning when you're teaching them Dharma, you know. It's you teach them stuff that they're interested in that will help them in their lives, okay? So I think in the West, I mean, that's why I teach so much about emotions and anger and things like that when I go traveling and talking, because that's what people are very, very interested in. That's what they have problems with in their life. You know, and I figure if I can teach that, then they'll create less negative karma. Yeah, and they'll begin to get some idea about how their own mind works, and that can, you know, give them a good foundation for what comes after that. Okay, so you have to teach people in their own language according to what they're capable of understanding. Okay, so we have to learn kitty language. Yes. So similarly, we initially teach in accord with how conventionally accepted things. So this is actually a good point. When new people, because we don't live in a Buddhist country. If you live in a Buddhist country, it's a little bit different. People have heard Buddhist ideas, or, you know, they know, they hear something here and there, even though they don't understand it. But in our situation, you know, nobody... most of the people, I think if you went into Newport and asked them what karma was, you know, isn't there, I don't know, isn't it, no, samsara is a perfume and nirvana is a band, and I think karma must be something. It's probably a line of clothing or something, you know. I don't know, but you know, people are going to look at my, oh, it's karma. You say, what, you know, I want to tell you about the Buddha. Buddha? Oh, Buddha, I know. That's that guy with the big belly when you go to a Thai restaurant. Yeah, they may, and that's even having some knowledge. Some people don't even have that connection. Okay? So you have to talk according to where people's minds are at. Yeah, so you don't kind of walk in and, you know, you've been to a Dharma course and you go home and your friend says, what'd you learn? And you say, oh, all about karma, nirvana, and samsara, and, you know, the paramitas, and Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, and, you know, that doesn't work. Yeah, what you do is you talk about love and compassion and generosity and, you know, fortitude and working with anger. And, you know, you talk about things that are commonly accepted that people already have a good feeling about. Yeah? So, I think I'm telling you all my old stories tonight. But were you there when we went to the Mennonite church?
I wasn't here yet.
You weren't here yet. Were any of you? Somebody, because, yeah, we went to the Mennonite church around the corner because they were having a fair. And I started talking to the minister's wife. And she said, you know, I mean, they knew we were Buddhist, or we told them we were Buddhist. And she said, well, you know, what's your idea about God? Yeah. So I wasn't going to say, you know. What I really thought, I said, well, you know, in Buddhism there's a very strong emphasis on love and compassion and developing tolerance for other living beings and being patient and not discriminating and being generous and, you know, really trying to expand our heart to have love and compassion and for everybody equally and, you know, keeping good ethical conduct so we don't hurt anybody. And I talked about this. And she was very happy, very happy, yeah, because it was already something she believed in, that she knows is good, yeah. So it's the best way, you know, when you're talking with people, you know, because sometimes, I don't know, I wind up on planes and people ask me, what is Buddhism all about, and, yeah, so... You don't say, well, it's about rebirth. And do you care about your future rebirth? You know, there's the hell realm.
I remember the first years at Create Good, when all of the flyers were stress, about harmony in families, how to have a meaningful job, forgiveness, you know, how to be kind.
Yeah,
like
right.
Yeah. Anxiety,
yeah. Yeah, that's what we did. If you look, His Holiness's public talks, always like that. Yeah, what he does in a public talk and what he does in a Buddhist teaching are quite different. Okay, so sentient beings have to understand how things work conventionally before they can even think about emptiness. Okay, so, you know, after you get them looking at their mind and calming down and everything like that, then you can start to talk about karma. And that leads into talking about ethical conduct. And then that leads into, you know, more about cause and effect and how things are impermanent and, you know, the importance of of having precepts and the importance of introspective awareness so that we, you know, are aware of what we're saying, doing, thinking, and feeling. So, you know, you kind of lead in by teaching all those things. So Chandrakirti said, conventional truth is the means, ultimate truth is the outcome of these means. Okay? So, and you can see that if somebody has a very solid understanding of cause and effect, it actually helps them a great deal when they learn emptiness and start meditating on emptiness, not to fall to nihilism, because they already have in their mind, oh yes, effects rise due to causes, and it's not just one cause, there needs to be a whole constellation of conditions, and it's all these things coming together, and they've heard that, and they're thinking about that. So then when they hear about emptiness, they don't immediately go, well, nothing exists. Okay? Then the next verse, I'm not sure we're going to get through it. This is kind of an interesting verse. Do you have some questions?
Just a comment about this scrutinizing, you know, before tantric teachings happen.
Uh-huh.
What I was thinking of with Lama Zopa Rinpoche is he teaches so late at night
that
everyone falls asleep. So there's one way of making sure that
people don't. Right. Yeah.
And then probably with His Holiness, His skill is such that, you know...
Yeah. Exactly. You know, because I think lots of times people come for the initiation.
Yeah.
But like you said, you know, with Rinpoche, you know, it's in the middle of the night, so people fall asleep. Or he coughs a lot, and then people leave.
Yeah.
And then with His Holiness, you can see in the big public initiations, he doesn't go into a lot of depth explaining the different steps of the initiation. If you've had initiations before, then you will know how to visualize and how to think. Yeah? But if you haven't, he doesn't stop and explain it when there's a big public thing. Yeah? So, you know, in some cases, you wonder if the people have actually taken the initiation. Because especially if people haven't been aware that when they're taking vows and commitments, you know, if they haven't been conscious, oh, I'm taking vows and commitments now, then they haven't taken, like, the bodhisattva vows or the tantric vows. And if you haven't taken those, then you can't, you don't really receive the initiation. Yeah, so in many cases, I think people, you know, that's what happens. So, yeah, but they do, you're right, have their own way of screening. Yeah. Other comments or questions?
Can I ask a question about Wasley?
Okay.
I was thinking about those two that Chandrakirti added on.
Oh, yes.
But the one about, you know, it's not the shape of the body.
Yeah.
What's going on at that time that he felt that was necessary, because it strikes me as kind of goofy.
Yeah, okay.
The one about the body already takes care of that.
Yeah, okay. So with the two added things that Chandrakirti added on to the emptiness, the refutation of inherent existence, you know, one was it's not the shape of the body, and it's not the collections. So the one of shape, it sounds sometimes a little bit simplistic. Like, yeah. Yeah. It could also be that I think the literal translation is shape, but I think it could also be translated as arrangement. Yeah. And here, you know, because just thinking that it's how to say, okay, you look at the car, yeah, and the car is this collection of all these different parts, and so one way to see that the car isn't the collection, that the designated object, the car, is not the basis of designation, it's parts, is to say, you just put all the parts in a pile right here. Is that the car? And the person says, no, it's a mess. But, and then you say, but you said that the car was the collection of the parts, and here's the collection of the parts, and it's not the car, is it? Okay. Then somebody's going to say, well, that's because the parts haven't been arranged in the right way. Take those parts and arrange them in the right way. Arrange them so that you have the shape of the car. Yeah. And everything's arranged where it should be. And then, yes, the car is the collection of those parts. So I think that's what it might be getting at. Because we do go, okay, yeah, the pile isn't, is that's not the car. But it they have to be arranged in the right way. Yeah. When the parts are all arranged in the right way, isn't that the car? Yeah, and our mind would say, yes, that's the car, isn't it? That's the car. You arrange all these things in the right way, that's the car. Yeah. And then you go, no, no. How, you know, what exactly is the car then? Are you saying the collection is the car? Are you saying the arrangement? What is an arrangement? If you're telling me the arrangement of the parts is the car, what is an arrangement? An arrangement of the parts is the shape of the car, the way the parts are put together. But is the way they're put together, is the shape, you know, is that the car? No. Yeah. So I think it's getting at that. Yeah. Yeah.
When you say for those who are not ready to receive the teachings on emptiness, there's this middle path and the wisdom path. How, like if you practice the middle path and there's a teacher or a sangha and they must have practice, of course, the wisdom path too.
Oh, yes, yes,
and
of course.
And there are some teachers like Kunu Lama, mm-hmm. who emphasize bodhicitta so much in his practice, and I wonder how much there is in his practice about emptiness too, because that's so emphasized.
Yeah, yeah. Then. Yeah, when we talk about the expansive, extensive lineage and the profound lineage, it doesn't mean that the lamas in those traditions only practiced method or only practiced wisdom. It just means that out of all the teachings they gave, what we're drawing out as being really important to us are their teachings on wisdom or their teachings on the method aspect of the path. Okay, it doesn't mean that they didn't practice the others.
Yeah.
And so, and I mean, same with Kunu Lama Rinpoche. He emphasized bodhicitta, you know. But obviously, somebody who emphasizes bodhicitta knows that wisdom is what you have to develop in order to accomplish what your bodhicitta is aspiring for. Yeah. So it's not that somebody who, you know, practices bodhicitta just does that and doesn't think about wisdom at all. If they did that, then they haven't really understood bodhicitta correctly. Yeah. Anything else? Yeah.
Well, I was curious from last week when I asked the question about going through those different kinds of those 20 ways of conceiving the eye. Like, I remember when you taught that a couple weeks ago, then you said, you know, how we all often go through these different ways of thinking about ourselves. Mm-hmm. And I think, so then I asked last week about, like, using that analysis to actually identify the object to be negated.
Mm-hmm.
So, I guess maybe I was wondering, is it the case that, like, not, it's not like identifying, it's not doing the analysis, but it's just watching our emotions arise when, you know, we have the thought, I am embodied, when we have the thought, you know, I'm dependent on my feelings. Is that actually like recognizing, you know, an emotion arising with the grasping at?
Okay. Okay, so when we're, I think I understand your question a little bit better now. When you're saying that those are 20 wrong views, so by identifying those 20 wrong views when we see them arise in ourselves, can we get a better idea of the object of negation?
Or is it a gross, maybe a gross?
Yeah. Those are all acquired views. So, yes, it's helpful to notice when we have them in our mind, but they're not the subtlest object of negation. Okay? But because we do have those gross views, yeah, and because acquired views can be, you know, if we hold on to them, they can be a huge obstacle. Then it's very good to notice when we have any of those 20 wrong views. Yeah? Or I should say 25 wrong views, because, you know, we throw in that each aggregate is separate from the person, you know. Then noticing when we have those and stopping and saying, is that true? You know, how am I conceiving the I? Yeah? So when we feel I in my body, you know, and this massive, I am my body. And then to stop and just look at that moment and ask ourselves, am I my body? What would happen if I were my body? That would mean that the word body and I were synonymous. Yeah, if I'm my body, then those two words are synonymous. Which means every time I say the word I, it refers to the body, because I am my body. So when I say I'm thinking, it means the body is thinking. Yeah? That doesn't sound right, does it? Body's not thinking. Okay? So it helps you develop some kind of analytical ability and some ability to identify the different thoughts that you have and then to doubt them and question them. Yeah. Or when you're feeling this very strong, I possess my body. Yeah, this is my body. Or these are my feelings. You're hurting my feelings. My feelings! Ah, my happiness, my suffering, you know, my feelings, you know, as if there's an I here and the feelings there. Yeah? Well, again, yeah, if I possess the feelings, in what way do I possess the feelings? Am I inherently one with them? Am I inherently different from them? Because if you possess something, you know, again, it's got to be either, in, you know, one or separate. So, it, you know, all those 20 boil down to, actually, the two, one and different. Yeah. So then you know, when these emotions come up in your daily life, yeah, to stop and then question them and ask yourself if that's true.
And it seems to me kind of like the innate ignorance is, in a way, just more kind of subtle or quiet than the
definitely
prior, but not really like a different view. But it's not. That's not.
No, no, it is different.
Yeah.
The innate ignorance, does not grasp the self as being either one or separate from the aggregates. The innate ignorance doesn't grasp the self as existing either that way. The innate ignorance is the self is something independent but mixed in with the aggregates. Yeah. It's independent, but it's mixed in with them. So actually, I mean, the subtle view of the self is actually quite difficult to realize. I mean, we don't even realize when we're thinking, I am my feelings, or I am my body, or, you know, or when we think, sometimes we think I'm totally separate from it, you know? Yeah, my body can get sick. I don't care. I don't feel anything. Yeah. So we go to that extreme. Yeah. So it's very good. Try and identify the gross things first, and then try and identify the subtle one. If you try and identify the subtle one without being able to identify the gross ones, yeah, it's going to be very difficult. So, you know, the idea they usually, or the example they usually give, which is quite a gross one, but it's still hard, is when somebody accuses us of something that we feel we didn't do, and it's unjust. That feeling of, but I'm innocent! Yeah?
I've been chewing on this innate or not two things. Mm-hmm. So the image that comes to me is like when you fall off a ladder, starting to fall off a ladder, mm-hmm. the self-grasping that comes up, vividly you think you're your body in that moment.
Yes.
How how can that be acquired? That just doesn't, like...
Yeah. I mean, okay, so how can that not be acquired? Because when you're falling off the ladder, how can it not be innate? Because when you're falling off the ladder, I'm my body. I have that same question. The reason they give, and this is something to chew on, is that, yes, that's true. We do feel, you know, in some way we feel I am my body at that point. But if that were an innate grasping, then we wouldn't at other times feel like, oh, gee, that other person is so attractive, I wish I could have changed bodies with them. In other words, we can have completely the opposite idea.
Yes.
Can't we? Yeah. And that thought just comes naturally in our mind. Oh, yeah, why can't I change bodies with that person? So they say because, you know, we can just as easily have that other thought that then thinking that we are our body is not complete, is not the innate object of negation.
Then I guess because I was just actually reading this thing that his Holiness wrote. So we have those three levels of grasping, so that we just are sitting here and we have the appearance of true existence, but we don't grasp it.
Right.
And then we have the place where we assent to it. And then we have the third step where we grasp.
No, assenting to it is grasping.
But he just defined three different ways. He said you agree to it and then you grasp at it. Anyway, even if there's only two. So
there's actually in the middle... Uh-huh. Is you think the self is self-sufficient, substantially existent.
Okay.
Yeah. Or actually, that can come after you grasp at true existence, and self-sufficient, substantially existent comes after that.
But anyway, my point is that we're not always grasping at that one. We're not always grasping at that one. We're not
right.
always grasping at that one.
Right.
So if it's innate, so it could be innate.
Yeah, and we're not always
grasping it.
No.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
It doesn't answer the question, but that's...
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So I think sometimes maybe they're using the word acquired, not in the sense of somebody sat down and said to you, you are your body, so you believe that. But maybe they're using the word acquired in the sense of it's not the subtle one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just anything that's not the subtle one, we'll just call that acquired because you can just as easily have the opposite thought. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's
it could be that way. Yeah. Okay. I thought we'd finish the chapter this week. We didn't. Okay. But I think you're getting a good idea, I mean, because some of these issues are coming again and again, of why we don't teach just emptiness and why we don't teach it at the beginning and the importance of why different people learn and practice different things and why we as an individual learn and practice different things at different times along the path. You know, hopefully these points are becoming clearer to you.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Lhotse's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Guru Namandala Kamiyataya Me. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Bodhisattva, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi, may it stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma, done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the West Florida.